Go Loud. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, we have Manuela Spinelli. Gareth and I have known her for a long time. You will know her as Trapattoni's interpreter from his time managing the Republic of Ireland. She's worked in the food world for a long, long time. I think she's been in Ireland the guts of 30 odd years. And good friend of Gareth's and mine. So we're looking forward to having
I obviously know her a little bit, slightly different because she's a work colleague of mine, because obviously when I was running Eurotalk, she was my right-hand person, if you like. Yeah. And with the Young Chef competition, obviously we work together a lot with that. I know you've known her as well, but from a work capacity, but she's a very diligent, super professional, and somebody that really cares about the Irish food scene and foodscape, you know, and like a huge promoter of Irish ingredients, farmers, chefs.
She's got a few opinions on Italian food too.
I'll mark my words, once she starts talking about Italian food, the hand will start going, because otherwise she's Irish most of the time until you start asking her about pasta or cheese or whatever. So she's a good old skin, Manuela, and she's very well loved in the Irish food scene, and I'm sure that'll come across today when we talk to her.
Absolutely. So we'll have Manu in our culinary conundrums, and Gaz is on the cookbook this week. Don't go anywhere. Okay, so it is cookbook corner time. It's your turn, Gareth. What are you going with this week?
Do you know, I'm going to choose a cookbook that I own, and I kind of, it's like a coffee table cookbook, and I own a couple from different chefs, but it's the Restaurant Patrick Gibeau cookbook, which was, I think it was in celebration of 20 years of the restaurant.
30 years, I think.
No, I think the cookbook came out, it was either 20 or 25 years. The restaurant has been around for 30 years.
Ah.
And the photographer that done the photographs is that famous Irish photographer.
Barry, no?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Barry McCall. He took the photographs. Yeah. Obviously with the people that run that restaurant, Kieran and Guillaume and Stefan and Patrick, all the recipes are 100%. It's not really a cookbook for the home cook, really.
I was just going to say.
No, the recipes are the most complicated. Even when I look at them, I find them, not even I, but they're so detailed.
You just take a look at the picture and say, I'll add this and that.
Through the years, I have Gordon Ramsay's 3-star book as well. And they're the type of cookbook that it's like a body of work from a restaurant that you admire from afar. And really, when I'm, Gary, we speak about this all the time, but a cookbook for a chef, it's somewhere that you're going to just stick your head into. We can find any recipe you want online, but there's something about picking up a book, flicking through, you'll see a flavour combination that you might have not forgotten about, but you kind of go, of course you do a pea and mint something, or of course you
do. Is there any particular dish in it that you've, like, have you eaten anything that's in the book, actually?
Yeah, I've eaten loads of things over the years that are in the book. He has a recipe in there with it's mango and coconut. I think it's pina colada, I think is the wording on the recipe. It's a dessert. Absolutely amazing. He has a pork tureen recipe in there. It's that famous recipe that he does with the prosciutto, or it's a parma ham and a tureen and fried quail egg. But there's just such detail in every vinaigrette.
You know something I love about Gibeau's and Kieran in that is, for such, steeped in French cuisine, really, like, and that, but you'll often see dishes just out of nowhere, then like Indian spices and all sorts of stuff like that, and that just amazing fusion cooking, I always remember one of the first times I wasn't expecting it. And Kieran's putting up a dish on Instagram or whatever, and you're taking a look at it, and I think, wow, sure, of course, like, and then just these little nuances and garnishes and sauces and oils and different stuff, and I thought, wow, like, they really, really go to the ends.
Yeah, for sure.
To get a dish bang
and,
on.
And the book feels exactly like that. So even if you weren't interested in cookery or food, or it's like picking up an amazing book of photographs
artwork.
Or instruments or whatever, you know, when you find these books. Anyway, Restaurant Patrick Ebo's book is the one I'm giving a shout out this week. So if you want to treat the foodie in your life, check it out. I'm sure you can still buy it online, and I know you can definitely buy it in the restaurant.
At the restaurant, yeah, for sure.
Cool.
Okay, so it is time for our weekly interview, and it's our dear pal Manu, or Manuela, as all you Trapattoni fans would know her as, you know, Manuela Spinelli. We have known you for many, many, many years. What people don't know is Manu works in the food world in Ireland, as well as being an interpreter, which we'll get into in a while.
She's also a professional WhatsApp group maker.
Yeah, she's a pain in the hole.
I am so under pressure here. You have no idea. This is the worst interview. Yeah. It's going to be the worst on
planet. You are very welcome to dishing it out.
Thank How you for doing? Having me.
Fresh from Monza, I believe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Over
yes, very excited.
Huh? Had you your Ferrari gear on you all weekend?
I did. I spent a fortune on Ferrari gear. Because, you know, you have to.
It has to be done.
Even if we lose.
Yeah.
That's the Italian spirit.
You've got used to losing for the last amount of years,
God.
Haven't you?
We're already at that point in the interview.
Ferrari are shocking at the minute. But anyway, welcome to the show. It's good to see
you. Thank you for having me.
That's all right. So tell us, Manu, how or what brought you to Ireland back in the day?
Jesus, we're going back a long time, very long time, because, that's...
Well, how long are we going back, actually?
32 years.
Wow, really?
Yeah, people think I came over when I got the job. When I got the job with Trap, but actually I've been here a long time. Came to study, believe it or not, and ended up staying. So came in... 93.
Wow.
A long time ago. And did
the year before one of the greatest
football
summers.
Yeah.
We kicked Italian ass in the summer of 1994. Where were you watching that game?
I was in Milan.
Were you?
Actually, with some Irish
friends.
That's
Scalacci, isn't
it? Yeah, that is.
And we beat them in the 94 World Cup, yeah.
Once.
Still happening.
Anyway,
though.
Manu, go on.
Yeah, we could be here all day just talking about football, really. So study, I graduated in UCD. I did a year abroad in Germany, and then I came back and I did a master's, because back in the days you had to do a master's if you wanted your degree to be recognized.
What did you study?
So studied languages, studied English and German, and then I did applied linguistics at Trinity. So yeah. So that was 6 years, and then...
Wow.
Ready to go. And I started interpreting, which is what I wanted to do all along. Actually started in rugby. First gigs were in rugby. And it was thanks to my experience in rugby that I then got the...
And you've worked for World Rugby for a long time, right? You still do?
I work for a number of sports organizations.
Brilliant. Deadly. And is there a big community of interpreters in Ireland the world,
actually,
or how does it work?
No, certainly not in Ireland, which is...
We're not recognised for being brilliant
with
that.
With that. There isn't a big community, but there's an international organisation of which I'm part.
How did the Trapattoni gig happen?
It was by chance, to be honest with you. Like, half the stuff in my life kind of just happens. I read an article in the papers. I read it was coming, and I figured the guy is bound not to speak a word of English.
School Italian. Maybe.
And also he was a very popular character in Italy, very popular figure in Italy. So we all know him. We all knew what he was like in public. It's like, you know, the current coach. We all know him. Mm. So I figured, okay, he's going to need something. So I sent a CV thinking, I'll never be called.
And did you send that to the FAI?
Yeah, sent a CV to the FAI. And then there was an interview process. So I believe there were a bunch of people being interviewed, actually. I didn't know at the time how many. But apparently it was... it was quite a long list. They didn't have obviously any experience with interpreting because they never required it before. So it was a bit of a minefield and kind of, I was initially hired for a 2-day gig, which was the announcement. And, you know, he was coming into Ireland and he was doing a big press conference to be announced. So initially it was a 2-day thing, which, you know, was already, for me, was like the biggest achievement. Mm. And then it turned into a 7-year.
Wow.
Nearly 7-year contract. So,
so is that why the FAI has no money left?
Yes, precisely. I bought...
They give you too much
money. I have holiday homes everywhere in the world.
Yeah, but it really was. I mean, it was actually a... I don't know. I'm trying to even think about the time. Like, Trapattoni was obviously a big deal for us or whatever, but at the same time, he was a boring dose. Like, he was a shocking.
I am not going to entertain.
What sort of a cat was he? Like, he was a good guy, though. Was he to work with?
It was amazing, amazing experience.
You speak very warmly of your time of doing that job. Obviously.
Yeah, I had a wonderful time. It was an incredible experience. I traveled the world. I worked with an amazing team. I mean, personally, and maybe there is a bit of a cultural, you know, barrier because obviously I was part of a group of Italians.
Yeah. But it was our first time, with a group of Irish. That, like, culturally that we seen somebody with an interpreter all the time because before, I can't actually think of any other example where, because every time he was there, you were standing just to the side of him,
it was really
whispering
bizarre.
In his ear.
I mean, and back in the days, I mean, I couldn't even go to Tesco because...
You were trapped.
I'd be stopped. So there was no more jammies going to the supermarket. You know, you kind of become very conscious.
But obviously we've known you for so long. Like, but I mean, you really were the most recognized face in the country when Trapattoni was the manager.
It's a funny one. But my mother would argue, you know, when people say, oh, you know, she worked with Trapattoni, my mother would argue, my daughter works with the Pope.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a bigger gig.
I was about to say, you've often said to me, you know, I was the voice of God today. And I'd be like, what? So I was always interpreting for the Pope. So.
Well, not always, but I had the opportunity. And then I had another gig that I think people cannot forget it. On the Late Late Show, I was again, the voice of the Holy Mary in that case, because there was a woman who was... one of the women from Medjugorje who was having visions. And I remember at the time being in with...
There's nothing the Paddies love more than somebody popping up in Medjugorje.
That was a challenging job.
It's true,
put it that way. Challenging one, both for me and Ryan Tobridy was conducting the interview at the time. But anyway.
There you go. But anyway, food then in Ireland. When did you get involved in our world? Was working with Eurotalks your first foray into it, or had you been
in Ireland? Yeah, I think the initial connection in Ireland was through Ross Lewis, actually, because Ross at the time was possibly the Commissioner General, or if not, he would have been involved on the board of Eurotalks, and I would have been very good friends with the guy who had the same role in Italy, simply because we're from the same town, and his name is Luciano, who then, you know, subsequently became friends with Ross as well.
Is that who has Asterio Lucio with Ross?
No, so, well, that's the reason behind the name.
Yeah, right, okay.
Way. So because they covered the same role and I'd done some work with Luciano in Italy. That's how the connection came about.
And now you're the head of community. So give people a bit of an idea what, because we talk about Eurotalk here all the time.
Yeah, I think the name is not very inducive to understanding what the association actually does, but it's we refer to it as a community of chefs who have come together to basically, the short of it is to put Ireland on the culinary map. You know, and you're both part of it. So it's a group of people who are really, really passionate about food and about Irish food. And I think our common objective is to inspire the future generations while not losing side of the history and the traditions and the heritage in Ireland, which is funny, and given I'm Italian, but I think my passion for food is really important, actually.
Is there anybody in Italy or from Italy that doesn't have a passion for food? Is it something, like, jokes aside, it seems that everybody's world evolve around
I was having these conversations. I mean, you know, in the past couple of weeks, there's been a lot of fun around specific Italian dishes. And we were having a laugh, but at the same time, I was having a serious conversation with people asking me, you know, is it so important if you add an ingredient or another to, and I was trying to explain that, you know, for somebody who is Italian, we feel like we're not good at many things. And particularly if you travel abroad or you work abroad or you live abroad, there's always this sense of a bit of a stigma of, I don't know if as Irish you have it as well, we're a country of immigrants. And, you know, there's always a bit of a stigma around it and you feel like you have to prove yourself. So when it comes to food, I think we feel a little bit entitled and we feel this is the one thing that we know how to do damn well. And so we're very protective of it. And everything in food is chosen very carefully. There's a lot of love, a lot of care, a lot of attention. And it's not just about whether there's cream or no cream in a dish, but it's about the culture, the heritage, the history, the narrative, the regionality and the passion that comes with it. And yeah.
And just to give the listener a little bit of context, Manuela just done an article with the Irish Times talking about carbonara, which is a recipe that's heavily bastardized in Ireland and England with chicken and mushrooms cream and... Where it has none of those things in it, like a traditional.
Yeah, absolutely. But the carbonara article is old. The ones I was referring to in the tit for tat last week was about cacio pepe.
Similar, same
context.
Well, what are people doing to make a balls of cacio e pepe? What are they?
I mean,
are they adding cream to that as well now?
The thing with Italian food is
I hope. I
just wonder.
Yeah. It's so easy. I've had 2 weeks of this, but Jesus Christ. Did you see that, Ed? Did you see the change of pace there? Yeah. Go on, sorry. I interrupted you.
I'm sorry. You see, I get faster, demon.
What's wrong with a bit of cream in there?
There's nothing wrong. There is absolutely nothing wrong. Throw the kitchen sink in it for what I care. Just don't call it cacio pepe. Cacio means something specific. It's a word. It's like Gary. There's one Gary. There's one cacio.
You can say that again. Say that again there for the listener. There's one Gary.
There's one Gary. But you know, things are there for a reason. Cacio is a type of cheese, a specific type of cheese. Pepe is pepper.
Pepper.
So it's very
what
simple.
What kind of cheese is cacio then? Cacio e pepe.
It's
Parmesan.
No.
You're some bollocks now. Stop it.
Yeah, exactly. Stop it. Anyway, it's irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant. But the whole point was put whatever you want. Put cream in your carbonara. Put peas. Put whatever. Just don't call it carbonara. Don't call it cacio pepe.
But I remember when I first went to Italy as a chef and I found it fascinating that like Parmesan or Reggiano, like it's regionalized, it's stamped, it can only be made in that one place. And now as I've gotten further into my career, there's loads of examples of that around the world.
Yeah.
Where there's huge examples of it in wine. I think Champagne is probably the obvious one, but then you've all around France, it's regionalized. Yeah. And the same in Italy. But
yeah, it's DOP and it's...
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Like it's from one specific place because it's the terroir. It's about the ground.
It's certification of origin.
And do you think that the Italians, were they the first to do that? I've never actually looked into this. No,
I don't think so, actually.
Do you know the reasoning behind it even?
Well, originally it was a means to protect the production of small crops or small
harvests or,
yeah, or produce, products, you know. So for example, I'll give you another. I mean, there's a zillion in Italy, you know, you have tomatoes from Pacino. I mean, we generally, it's like a produce plus the location where it comes from. So it could be hazelnut, it
could be balsamic
vinegar, it could be Parmigiano Reggiano, it could be, I think Grana Padano is even prosciutto. You know, there's a zillion products. The whole thing was born as a certification and of origin to protect certain small production and the authenticity of certain production. So if you're making, a champagne style wine, not in a champagne region, it cannot be called champagne. It would be called something else, or it should French be called Cordero, something else. Yeah. Exactly. So it is the exact same with a lot of our produce, and we have
That's a lovely thing, though.
Really wide variety. So for example, in my area, like I'm from outside Milan, used to be part of Milan. It's now Monza, hence the...
Oh, is that home?
Yeah, that's home.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So what they're trying to do at the moment is to get a specific type of sausage recognized as DOP. It's called Luganica di Monza. And I have a friend who's a butcher and very involved in the movement. So
is that the one with the fennel in it or no?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you've brought me some
well,
of that
no,
already.
It doesn't have the... Well, yes and no, yeah.
There's never a blatant straight answer with an Italian, is there? Yeah, no, that's it. No, that's not it. Yeah, it's kind of...
Well, is they make the sausage, it? But Lugan- some of them are flavored, some of them are not.
I'll bring you some more.
There you go.
We use it to make risotto. Specifically, so it's a specific type of sausage that
you probably have loads of opinions on risotto as well.
Oh
man,
gosh, yes. yes. I'd probably be really criticized for saying what I'm saying. I actually never order it in a restaurant. I'm very fussy when it comes to risotto. If it's overcooked,
No, you should have just finished there, Mamela. I thought you're very fussy when it comes to food. And one of the questions I was actually interested to ask you was, have you seen a shift in the Irish food culture since you've lived here? You arrived here in 1993, we're in... You know, definitely. Almost 30 years or more than 30 years ago. So
absolutely. I mean, an incredible shift to the point that, you know, when friends or friends of friends come over and ask, where should I eat? You know, now it's such a pleasure to say to people, oh, you should go here, you should go there. There's such a wide variety of restaurants and chefs. And I think what's been good as well about it is the fact that Ireland is very welcoming to influences, to different influences from abroad or from, you know, chefs from different ethnicity as well, which is great. It's really great to see.
And do you think that's unusual in the landscape of the food world?
Well, again, as an Italian, I think we're much more narrow-minded when it comes to food. I mean, now in Italy, you're starting to see Indian restaurants or Japanese.
I was about to ask you that. Do you have a variety in, say, Rome or Milan, like you would the big cities, probably?
Yeah, but
say the smaller towns or cities in all the time.
Not a chance. Right. So the most popular cuisine outside of Italian in Italy is probably Japanese, because we're extremely fascinated by Japanese food. So you would probably find a Japanese.
So I'm not going to get a spice bag or a chicken ball when I'm in there.
Not on the planet. No.
So you're all brainwashed then, really, into thinking that there's nothing but Italian food good for you.
Oh gosh. Oh my God.
The ingredients, though, the ingredients are incredible, though, but the dishes are.
It's not that we're brainwashed. It's just like, if you can drive a Ferrari, why would you drive a 500?
Well, you got
what
me.
What car
there.
Do you drive?
A 500, because I can't.
There you go.
Because I can't afford a Ferrari.
Yes. But yeah, do you think Italian people are missing out a little bit? Or like, because now, right, you have a very diverse palate, right? And you know a lot about lots of different cuisines.
And funny you should say that, because when I'm with Italian friends and we eat out, they just laugh at me because they say my palate is no longer Italian because I'm so used to spices. You know, for me, it's normal. Spices and different, you know, different foods, and they aren't. They simply aren't. So they say my palate is all over the place, and I say, well, actually, see, this is where I become a bit Irish with it, and I go, well, actually, I know better.
I'm a bit more cultured. Yeah.
But I would always say, Manuela, the thing that impresses you most, and obviously we travel a lot, we're Eurotalk and we eat together a lot, it's when something simple is done very, very well.
Yeah.
And sure. I would see, you would recognize that really quickly. And I've always wondered, is that because of your culture or your background, where I would probably be looking for a bit more technique, or I'd look for a bit more, sometimes.
I do believe it's cultural. I really think, you know, we grow up with humble food. I don't know if the new generations, you know, I don't know if it's the same now, because they certainly, a lot of people in Italy buy ready meals as well. But we certainly, my generation.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. But they're, ready meal, but with style, even if it's, you know, like.
Is there such a thing though?
Yes, of course. It has to be made in a certain way, even if it's ready meal. You know, you don't go to a supermarket necessarily, but we have Gastronomia, which is like a shop that sells ready-made food, but it could be freshly made pasta, freshly made rice salad.
Similar to France.
Yeah.
Where you're seeing,
like,
buying
a rotisserie or, you know, so it's ready, like it's ready, but it's...
high quality.
Yeah, in that sense, like, I don't mean to be across like stuck up, but it's available to everybody. It's not like a luxury.
Would you notice when you're in any of the big cities, like when you're in Rome or Milan or Siena, like there'll be a big American chain fast food place on most of the corners, even in the squares now, and they're packed with like young, you know, school kids up to people in their early 20s, like much more so than here, I would say.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you're, I know there's one in Siena in particular, right on that square, it's beautiful. And one of them, one of the biggest restaurants on the square is a big Golden Arches, like it's a big McDonald's.
Yes.
And wedged. Now, when you go in there, you can buy arancini in a McDonald's.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, you know, there's a bit of the culture, but it's like there's a little bit of a fascination with the American fast
food. For sure. For sure.
Because they just never get it, I suppose.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. And the same with, I would say, with Japanese takeouts and,
What, like Chinese sushi bars? And
Sushi bar would be, you know, top of the list, definitely. But it is, like, it's a way of living. It's, you know, for us, it's not just about food. And you've both traveled, you lived in France, and... It's a way of life. It's, you're sitting around, we sit around and we eat and we share food, and it's by sharing food that we get to know people, that we get to know other cultures and so on and so forth. So we're, you know.
So where do you love to eat Italian in Ireland then? Like, is it, I know you know all the chefs, and not to single one over the other, but like who does it brilliantly in Ireland?
Honestly, I don't eat Italian when I go out. I try not to go to Italian restaurants when I go out, but I do like going to Grano.
Yeah.
I think they do a great job. It's very simple. It's, you know, it is what you would expect if you're going into a restaurant in Italy, like a small restaurant in Italy, and so I appreciate what they do. They try to stay genuine as much
as
possible.
What is the greatest Italian dish of all time?
The greatest Italian dish of all time. Oh, how long have you got?
Yeah, exactly. I was just thinking we need to.
Yeah, like what do you like? What's the one that you're most proud of?
Spaghetti al pomodoro.
Yeah.
Yeah, simple as like a good plate of spaghetti with a homemade tomato sauce with tomatoes picked from the garden. And you sit with your grandma and you pass the tomato, you cook the tomatoes down, then you pass them through this yolk like a machine, you know.
That wheel. Yeah.
And then you just, as simple as, funny enough, I cooked it for party of friends, you know, we're having dinner. We were each preparing a dish and I thought, I'll just make pasta pomodoro. Boom.
But that's one then where Gareth mentioned there earlier, like about ingredients, like that's where, like, unless the tomato
absolutely
is a humdinger,
absolutely,
it's
absolutely,
it's going to taste like an acidic mess, or
absolutely, absolutely. But if it's well made, it's the nicest thing on the planet and the best I've probably eaten, and well, one of the best I ate was in. Actually a tree stud in Italy, which, and again, not showing off, just happened to be there and they literally just made a pasta with tomato sauce. And I was just like, whoa, paradise. Yeah. So yeah,
it's amazing,
I think,
though,
simple
when get,
things.
When you get simple stuff like that with two or three ingredients, like it can be special.
Yeah.
You know, we...
Yeah, we were in the, Lake Garda a few years ago, and we were eating it. We brought, so part of it, Gary, you know this, but part of the young chef competition that we're involved in, when the finalists, we bring them for lunch somewhere. So we brought them to Lake Garda, to this restaurant. Two Michelin star, I think.
One.
I was one.
Lido 84.
But one of the dishes that stood out most, there was two dishes that we had that day that I think about quite often. And one of them was a type of pumpkin that he made a soup. And he literally roasted this pumpkin in the oven, pureed it with some vegetable stock, and it was finished with a little bit of an oil, I think a pumpkin oil. But it was so simple. But the chef came out and he was like, I just really wanted to celebrate this ingredient because it's right in season. And I was like, wow, that took such guts. Yeah. Even though, like, for him, he was just making this soup, but you could really taste that one particular thing. And then he done another dish, which was actually cacio pepe that he cooks in a bladder.
Pig's bladder.
Oh, really?
And then into stock. And then they put the cheese and the pepper and the pasta is in there. But when it came out, he opened it. So he comes out, it's like a big balloon.
Yeah.
And he comes to the table and he pours this pasta into the dish. And it came to the, and I was looking at it, and he finished it with a little bit more pecorino, and then he went into the kitchen, and I was sitting beside, again, a friend of ours, Kieran Glenn, who works in a 2-star, he's the head chef of a 2-star Michelin restaurant, and I looked at him and he looked at me, and the both of us ate the pasta, and I was calling to him, do you reckon this is cooked? It was so al dente.
Yeah.
Now, and now it was very nice, but it was a very different experience, and I said to Manuela, was that supposed to be that al dente? Because our palates are just not used to it.
Yeah.
Now, I trusted that the guy that was cooking it.
He knew what he was doing.
Yeah. But it was really, really...
So it's like... again,
crunchy,
I would say. We go back to risotto. I cook mine 14 minutes max.
Yeah.
You know, and it's probably, for you, it would probably be under...
Chalky.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it wasn't under... It was an experience that I remember. Yeah. And look, it was very... I mean, there was loads of lovely things that we ate that day. But they were too... And I mean,
surely that is too al dente, no? No?
No, it was fresh pasta.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I love al dente pasta, but...
No, this was, remember?
It's, yeah.
Bitey.
So I'll ask you a question. Yeah. Let's do a role reversal here.
I can't imagine that being nice.
I'm going to ask you a question. Do you think Ireland is ready for a real, genuine Italian restaurant? Like, no cream, you know, the recipes as they should be.
Well,
like,
are the best, like, Italian restaurants in Dublin, say, not already doing that? No.
Again, I'll be honest
with you. There's no part of me that'd be waking up someday going, geez, I hope somebody opens a really authentic Italian restaurant.
No,
this
I think
year
there's
in
a lot of people who work well, but inevitably you adapt to a country. You know, you try to feed the palate. And so hence why the sauces and maybe why the pastas are richer than you would normally find in Italy. You know, I do think that, look, ultimately it's about making money. So, you cook what the guests want. But, you know, like, is there space for a pumpkin on a plate kind of thing?
Oh, sure. I think the people that really know food in Ireland or really appreciate food Absolutely appreciate stuff
Should
being
we
done
invest
right.
Then, Gary. Do you want to open a restaurant?
I don't know if I'd be investing in an Italian restaurant, but I mean,
I think the general public's perception, and I'm not trying to generalize here, yeah, of an Italian restaurant is slightly different to what a trattoria is when you're different parts of Italy. Yeah. Like, I mean, I've been up the top and down the bottom and they felt quite different. And then when you get into a conversation with somebody from the top of Italy, they have an opinion about the bread and the pasta and the
scutri. Well, that's the one beautiful thing about Italy. I'd say it as well about India is the regionality. Like, then the fact that, you know, as much as we love Ireland and, you know, we're proud to talk about Ireland and the different food. You've worked in the food world in Ireland for the guts of 30 years here. But, you know, that regional or cultural mark is not there like it is in Italy, or say different regions of India, like where they eat things a certain, even France.
It's a matter of time.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about the amount of small artisan producers we have now in Ireland, if I think about it 30 years ago, there was probably 3-4 and now we have an abundance of, so I think it's time and culture and, you know, appreciation as well, like the Irish part.
The one thing I really want to know, do you take coleslaw with your lasagna?
I tried to die.
Right, Manu, we always ask for our death row dinners, your last supper. We always ask everybody.
How many courses?
At the end, you can have whatever you want, whatever.
Okay.
Whatever
suits
you. I will
have vitello tonnato for a starter. For sure. Obviously, I'm going Italian.
I was
going
to say now, you better put, and I bet you she chooses a chocolate dessert.
Not a chance on the planet.
What's your starter?
Vitello tonnato.
Say that in Spanish. What is it?
I don't know.
It's veal with a tuna mayonnaise almost.
Yeah. Veal with a tuna sauce. It's a mayo, essentially, with
it's very, very nice. And some capers.
And anchovies. And it's traditional from, it comes from Piedmont originally, and it's done with very thin slices of veal and with this beautiful tuna sauce. So, and I love it. But, I mean, it's very difficult to choose, but now I feel like that. Maybe tomorrow, if you ask me tomorrow, I'll have a different opinion. Then pasta al pomodoro, for sure, as I already spoiled.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler the whole thing. For main, my mother's rabbit. My mom makes amazing rabbit on a Sunday. So I want to die with it. And dessert, I hate chocolate. I do not like chocolate. And anybody who knows me knows I don't like chocolate. So it will be something like an apple dessert or a fruit dessert or a tiramisu is always a win as
I
well.
I love tiramisu.
Yeah, I'll give you my recipe, my mother's recipe.
Really do.
And there's nothing Irishy that's going to creep in there at all, no? Like, there's no celebration
if I was,
of like Irish beef or
if I was
Irish
to go
seafood,
Irish, I would go definitely Irish potatoes. For my main course, I would want lamb and Irish potatoes. And I would want my lamb. I love the fat in the lamb. You know, I love when you cook the lamb and you have this beautiful fat melts down with some lovely spuds in possibly two different forms. Like I would have a mash and I would have a roast potato dish. I would have for starters, oh gosh, maybe scallops, because Irish scallops are amazing and you don't have to do much to them. So, yeah. And for
cheese.
This, yeah, I'll go cheese.
I'll help you.
Yeah, the cheese is good. Huh?
We had this amazing cheese that actually with Eurotox, we do some. Every year we do food awards, which is an opportunity to put on the, you know, shine a light on some artisan producers. And I tried this cheese, which I did not know. It's called Ballylisk.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. I really enjoyed it. I love Kyle Moore, Santola. I mean, there's so many Cashel Blue. There's Cashnatira, there's so many cheeses I love right now.
Yeah, I mean, I've often talked about the Glee Brehon, like, God rest him, David Tiernan's is the greatest cheese that's ever been made in this country.
Yeah,
you could argue Crozier Blue when it was around, or Cashel Blue as well, but that Cashnatira is absolutely
I actually do not buy, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, I just don't buy French cheese because we have such an amazing
variety. I was in the Chateau in France, I bought Irish cheese.
Yeah,
I brought them over.
I bring them home to Italy, actually. When I go home, I
Irish
bring
lamb and Irish,
Irish
beef
cheese.
It was the three things that I stuck with.
Always bring Irish cheese. I bring honey. You know, if I travel to Italy, I bring cheese, I bring honey.
We've got our own hives in the K Club, actually. I just got the batch. The honey yield's way down this year across the country. I don't know if you've heard that. It's down about 45% across the whole of Ireland, the honey yield. But yeah, I got a lot coming to my kitchen this
week. Taste of Ireland. Honey is just such a beautiful, you know, you
That's something we should probably look into, actually, because it was only when the gardener said it to me during the week at the K Club, like they were saying that, you know, we've got a pretty good yield. It's down on last year, but the whole country. And I was like, oh, I was almost saying that to Gareth and take a look into it and see what's going on.
Yeah, I just love it because you can taste the edges, you can taste the flowers, you can taste.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, look, thanks so much for coming in. And that's a little bit of a look into the world of Mamela.
Thank you for having me.
Interpreting and food. So, yeah, thanks
a million. I was terrified, but
nothing to be worried about.
Off the hook.
Good to see you.
All right, Mamela. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you so much.
Cool.
All right, so. What do you think? Manu got the hands working, right?
That's what I was about to say. She was being all so polite and all, and then once she started talking about pasta and tomato sauce, the hands start going as if she was...
I was winding her up there because should pasta be that crunchy?
She was so agitated. Anyway, she's a good old skin, Mamelo, as I said, and look, a brilliant interview as we knew it was going to be. So from there we go into our culinary conundrums. Ed, have we any? I hope we have a few questions about how long you should cook risotto or how al dente pasta should be served.
Unfortunately not, but so from the sublime of Manuela to the ridiculous of me, but some good questions in all the same. This is one that I can relate heavily to. Declan in Kildare. Lads, serious question, so you know. What's the best way to reheat leftover chips so they don't taste like cardboard?
Oh, dude.
Here we go.
Who
has chips that are left over? Do you not eat all the chips?
Of course you do.
It's like having leftover wine. I don't understand the question.
There's no such thing as leftover
You're
wine.
You're breaking up.
Yeah. Do you know what? That's a tough one. If it's homemade danglers, as we call them in Remelton, John Tegg's chips, Daddy's chips. If it's a homemade chip, I'm guessing it's not. You actually could get away with just refrying them again. That's the best way of doing it without them having a plastic finish. If they're skinny chips, open whatever coloured bin of your choosing and
the
put
brown
them
bin.
Into it. Put them in the bin.
Oh, I hate
and
skinny
move
fries.
On.
I hate skinny. When I go to a restaurant or a bar and they're like, oh, they come with skinny fries. Oh.
Forget about it.
You immediately dislike the person.
Having said that, I'm not a huge fan of those Jenga chips either. What I call them, they come out and they're coming out like blocks.
They're just
like
too
hot enough is what try and charge you an extra few quid. That's what we call them in the trade.
I'm like the Goldilocks of chips. That's
Would you like a
skinny.
Pot enough?
Yeah, 9 quid.
Yeah, four chips. No, you're grand. Give me a basket of chips. Stop acting the bollocks.
Be honest to God, they come out in.
I love an old McDonald's skinny chip. Now, when I go to Mickey D's, like I say to them, listen, the chips have to be fresh.
Yeah.
And a little trick. Just a little chef trick. You say, could I have my fries, please, with no salt? And they've got to give you a fresh one because they season them all. So
all
if they say
me.
No, just say, okay, no salt, please.
they love you for it.
Yeah.
I'd be checking the burger there on Gary. So you're saying just pop them, refry them.
Refry them if they're homemade danglers and they're big. If they're skinny, bin. Can't be done.
Or just eat them when you cook them.
Yeah, give them to the dog. How are you, lads? What's the weirdest or most outrageous thing you've ever been asked to cook? Did we have this before? Barry in Ballina. The most outrageous thing you've ever been asked to cook?
I worked in years and years and years ago, and I worked in Sydney. There was a family staying, and they went out to... one of the shores around Sydney, and they caught a little flathead, which is a flathead is kind of like a, it's like a flounder nearly. And the kid came in, and back then you could actually, I filleted it and I made fish and chips for the little fella for his dinner. And it, like, I know if it, some of the restaurants around Ireland that have fishing around them, if you catch a fish, you bring it up to the hotel. But really? I was working in a hotel right in the centre of like the CBD, the central business district. And the last thing is I was expecting that someone to come in with a fish in a bag.
One little fish.
So I filleted it. I put it through a tempura. The little fella had it for his dinner. And I remember how excited he was to eat this fish. Yeah, it was kind of cool. Mm. It's not particularly that weird, but it's something that sticks in my mind of a time that I was asked to cook.
Did you charge him?
Hmm?
Did you charge him?
Yeah, I charged him about $97.
Big chunky chips.
Yeah. Would you like that one pot enough?
Would you like five chips?
No, I can't remember. It was, No, and look, occasionally, I'll tell another story of a phone call I got off a fella. And you know who he is. He's actually passed since, but he's Jeff Duke rang me before. Right. He was a friend of a lot of chefs. He owned it,
crockery and business. Yeah,
and he rang and he says, "If someone was to cook a swan, well, how would they go about it?" I says, "Sorry,
what?"
Yeah, well, I then learned that. Now I didn't tell him how to cook it. But I says, I'd approach it the same way I'd cook a turkey. That's what I told him, right? But apparently somebody was shooting and a swan got shot. I can't get him in trouble now because he's not with us anymore. But then he told me the story about that swans are protected under the Queen's royalty, even in Ireland.
Yeah.
That you're not allowed to shoot swans.
No.
And I wouldn't actually recommend going out to shoot swans, just so you know.
Was it tasty though?
I don't even know.
It's quite gamey.
No, it wasn't. It? What?
Is it quite gamey?
I have no idea. I didn't even see it. But I
don't know. It looks like he had it.
Yeah, no, I 100% didn't.
Well,
he rang me when I was in work. And I would have
told the truth.
I'm telling the truth. I'm actually telling the truth. It was probably
I'm
a little bit.
Jigging
yeah, I'm actually going. Exactly. Fuck off. Yeah, don't start that shit.
Yeah. Took the soup and the swan.
Yeah. €3 a kilo.
The swan soup.
Yeah, yeah. Small baby.
Is the meat
chicken
the same color as a turkey?
I actually have no idea. But I'm sure it'd be like, it'd have to be like a blade of turkey, would it? Maybe. No idea.
Some little posh kid.
Anyone knows out there? There you go.
After catching this bloody swan, cook it for me.
You have some neck on you.
Yeah. Really? Boom, boom. He's here all week.
Anyway, that is some kind of answer. This is from Paddy and Ennis. Kind of not in the same vein, but all right, boys, what's the one food you'll never touch? No matter how fancy the restaurant.
Oh, swans.
Even if I cook a fish.
Is there anything you look on the menu?
Escargot, actually.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Not for me. Yeah, snails for all you heathens out there. Mm. Yeah, it's gotta go.
Heathens.
You ever eat periwinkles? I grew up gathering periwinkles, eat them with a pin.
Yeah.
Don't know if I'd eat them now, but I used to gobble. I used to tear into them with granny back in the day.
I can't eat raw langoustine or raw lobster because they give me an allergic reaction and I can't eat kiwi because I'm allergic to them.
Really?
And steak tartare is another one I eat.
Do you?
Like
steak tartare.
No.
No, there's not actually, there's stuff if I see it on the menu I wouldn't shoot to order it, but if I'm out eating somewhere I can't think of anything that
I try everything, yeah. Mm-hmm. Even the escargot, I've eaten it, but I don't mind
the escargot.
Do you bite into it or do you just swallow it like an oyster?
The escargot?
Yeah.
No, you chew it. Yeah, no, they're sorry.
No.
They're normally cooked in so much garlic butter.
Yeah,
it's all
really
garlic.
That's nearly that that
it's
I
just
don't
the texture,
like.
It's just
it? The quantity of garlic generally.
I'm going to wrap this question up before I do.
Yeah.
The opposite of drooling. So Paddy and Ennis and Barry and Bannon and all the rest of you, thank you all so much for your excellent conundrums this week. And keep them coming. Food at goloudnow.com.
So look, thanks a million as always for tuning in, and don't forget to share the love to the boys. So if it really helps the podcast if you can give it a like to whatever platform you're listening to it, or indeed share it with a friend, and make sure you tune in next week where we'll have more culinary conundrums, cookbooks, and a wonderful guest, I'm sure. Thanks a million.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.